Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. We're excited to announce that Series 1 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the smart thinking money app, Yolt. Yolt is an app that I personally use, so I'm delighted to partner with them. You can sync your accounts, credit cards, and pensions in one view and track your spending habits, how much you're spending and what you're spending it on. I buy a lot of coffee. Yolt takes the stress out of budgeting and gives you the tools to achieve your financial life goals. For me, that's a trip to French Polynesia. Download Yolt for free from the App Store or Google Play Store today. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by luxury influencer Victoria McGrath, known online as In The Fro. Victoria started her social media journey back in 2012 and has seen the business side of the influencer industry evolve firsthand. She has worked with brands such as Dior, Thomas Sabo, and Bulgari. Her first ever brand campaign was with L'Oreal.
It was just for their Elnett hairspray, and it was just a one-off job, and it was a video, and I had to, if I can remember rightly, I had to create a video with a few different hairstyles with the Elnett hairspray, which was super easy, because it's an amazing hairspray anyway, which I used. So, yeah, just put it together.
So YouTube video was the first piece of branded content that you did. Did you have to do any social support with that?
I feel like I probably did do an Instagram, maybe even a tweet. Because I also remember, I feel like back in the day, there was a lot more focus on Twitter. Did you feel that as well?
I remember the phase when it was all kind of YouTube, which was kind of 2015. But I suppose, I mean, early doors, I don't know if I was much into looking at the branded content side of things back then.
Oh, yeah, true. But yeah, I guess so. And I suppose also back then, not as many people were putting ad. Well, we weren't told to put ad or spawn or all these different things that people have used. So back then, a lot of tweets probably did pass under the radar and people didn't realise they were branded. But I do feel like back in the day, more brands were really focused on, like, can you tweet about this and promote this through Twitter? And whereas I feel like that's kind of died a death now.
I mean, I love Twitter, but yeah, I don't see as much branded content on there.
No, not so much now.
Do you think that back in the day when it wasn't kind of the hashtag ad and the hashtag spawn, that was just not anything kind of calculated? It was just brands seeing it sort of as press, just blurring the boundary of it. I don't know, because maybe it was a new form of media, even though they must have been able to know the regulations from working with magazines previously.
I guess so. Yeah, from working with magazines, they probably did know the kind of deal with it. But I think because it was such a new platform for everybody, I think it was just blurred lines entirely. So there wasn't any, like, real guidebook to follow for anybody. No one really knew what they're doing. So I don't think it was anyone trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. I think it was just literally that no one had been told how to do it properly.
And do you think management, I suppose, because it was the first generation of digital first talent agencies, so they was probably learning on the way?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was just a massive learning curve for everyone, I think. When the ASA did start to really put the foot down with it and be like, this is the way it needs to be, and they started to come up with these guidelines. I remember Gleam were like, right, this is what you're doing, this, this and this. Go back through old content, change this, this and this.
Oh, so you went back through the old content and changed it as well?
In the most recent videos anyway, like the past, like, four videos before at least, I went back and made sure that they definitely said ad, just to kind of adhere to the guidelines. And then going forward from there, when the guidelines had kind of been put into place, I made sure everything was perfect going forward, yeah.
When you look back at the beginnings of your career and that time, do you look at it through rose-tinted glasses? Was it the glory days, or are you, I mean, you're obviously in a very phenomenal 2018 so far.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you view the olden days?
I feel especially that YouTube definitely had, like, a golden day. Around, like, the 2014, 2015 kind of mark, when it was massively on the uphill. And there's loads of things happening. It was a really exciting space. But at the same time, oh, and also I suppose with Instagram as well, because Instagram back then didn't really have all the algorithms and you could put up a picture and actually reach all of your audience, and it was getting really exciting because of that. And I suppose it is different now. But at the same time, I feel with that evolution of all the channels and the people using the channels, it's just become a bit more professional and a bit more streamlined.
Which in some ways is nice, but do you think that that has had a negative impact sometimes on the community side? I mean, Melanie Murphy, our current cover star, put up a video yesterday and she's saying all the things that are being promoted to her on YouTube are clickbait titles about bad things happening or being negative about other people.
Oh, God, I'm so sick of seeing it. Drama.
Yeah.
It's constant drama. I don't know when YouTube became that, but I think it's because I don't follow many things like that. I don't get recommended it on YouTube, so I don't see it as much, thankfully. But the things I do see, it's like, where is this like drag culture come from? Why is YouTube like this now? People just dragging each other down for views. It's
and being quite
awful.
manic content. I mean, yeah. I don't know if that stems actually from the US and from those infamous Paul brothers that
oh, yeah.
have had an impact on yeah that type of content. But back to brand work. So first kind of YouTube video with L'Oreal. Now you're obviously an ambassador.
Yeah.
So what other kind of campaigns came through and how did you differentiate? Was that very much conversations with management? Had you outlined to start with the kind of brands that you wanted to work with?
I think at the beginning, especially, it was a big open space for brands especially to get involved with. And I remember seeing more and more brands become more interested and excited by YouTube. I remember when I first started it, there wasn't as much interest in YouTube. But I mean, saying that though, I was very much growing back then. Like I was a much smaller channel and, you know, maybe I didn't get the opportunity that some people were getting. So it's hard to say entirely, like speaking for the whole industry. But for me especially, it kind of became more and more exciting. More brands became more interested in this space and promoting via YouTube and Instagram. Then over like the next year or so, when more brands became like excited by the channel, there became more options of who to work with and more opportunities. And then it kind of came to a point where it was like, right, I don't want to put my name to everything. I need to be selective. And that's when me and Gleam kind of really chatted about it. Like, right, where do you want to take everything? Who do you want to be? So, and that's kind of around the time, actually, when I decided I wanted to go much more down the luxury beauty and fashion route. At the time, in the UK, there were barely any bloggers doing, like, luxury fashion beauty, and that had always been my passion. So I was like, this is kind of where I want to head more down and do a lot more kind of reviewing and dressing with luxury. So it was kind of around that time, really, we were like, well, this isn't going to work for me. This particular brand deal isn't right. This won't work for the future, you know, that sort of thing. So we kind of worked together and made sure that I was on the right journey, I suppose.
So talk me through Bulgari, that campaign, which you posted on Instagram in sketch. How did that come about from start to finish? Yeah.
Okay, so with Bulgari, it's always been a brand I've loved. And over the past maybe 2.5 years, we've worked on a very kind of organic relationship. I know those guys really, really well. We're really good friends now at this point. And we just sort of build that up over different like events we've been to and things they'd invite me to. And it kind of got to the point where they were like, we have some budget for a project. We'd love to get you involved. Because I'd always done things on an organic basis before then. And they obviously really understood how much I adored the brand, so they wanted to kind of invest in me and show me that they were also really interested in what I could do. So they came to me and said, we'd love for you to promote the new eyewear collection. And also they were working with two other girls, I think, and they'd kind of got this idea for what the other two girls were going to do. So my fiance,
I know, congratulations,
so exciting. So my fiance Alex, he is my photographer and videographer, and they knew that, and they knew that I usually always like to only shoot with him. So they were like, we kind of want to see what you can do, like what could you and Alex do that's a bit different. So I just came up with this concept, this idea of going to Sketch, because it's my favourite restaurant, it's so pretty. I just thought it would make a really beautiful space for an advert, for like a little mini movie. And then when we were there, we were like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we did like stop motion? So we did a bit of that. And then it was kind of a bit on the fly as well with some of like the creative ideas.
But that's in the best way, isn't it?
I think so. Because when you're in the mood and you're in the moment, sometimes it's like, oh, this could be great. So we kind of did that. But generally, the whole kind of concept came from Bulgari. They had this idea for the eyewear project. Took it to me. I completely
Does that land in your personal inbox and then you pass it on? What's the ratio of stuff? How does that work?
It all depends on relationships. Well, I would say 95% of people I work with, I already have very amazing relationships with anyway. If it's a new brand that comes in, they'll often go via Gleam. And then obviously then when I meet them, I build my own relationship. But with Bulgari, I'm really, really good friends with the ladies there. So they came to me, asked if I would be interested, and then I passed it on to Gleam to sort of sort out all the finer tuning and details, which is great because I'd have no idea how to do all that.
Yeah.
And I just came up with a creative treatment for it, pretty much.
I was going to ask you about direct relationships as well, and how important do you think that they are as an influencer?
So I would say I am honestly the person that will say the most, networking is the biggest and best thing you can possibly ever do. For me, I would say the majority of the amazing projects I've got have been through my own relationships. I am continuously in meetings, constantly meeting people, chatting through their ideas, what they've got coming up, what I've got coming up, you know, like throwing ideas around. And there's no way I would have got, I'd say, 70 to 80% of the things that I've done in the past 2 years, I would never have got those if I had not gone and chatted with people and got to know them as friends, you know, and just networked. No way. And also, I must admit, the amount of times I've been in meetings with PR teams and they've told me how off-putting it is to try and work with talent or influencers who are behind like a glass shield. They can't get close to them. They can't make any kind of relationship with them. If you can't even email someone and ask them something quickly, it just makes it very difficult, doesn't it? And I find a lot of PRs will talk about the fact that they don't want to work with particular talent because they can't get any close to them.
How much feedback do you get on the campaigns that you do? Because I know that there have been some talent that say that it gets a filtered down version. Are you very kind of strict on it? You want to know everything, if they're happy, exactly what they're happy about.
Do you know, I would say I'd maybe like to know more, I must admit. But I think because things are always so fast-paced and move into the next thing that sometimes it gets missed off. But usually I'll WhatsApp my managers and be like, what do they think of this? Do you like it? And that's usually always at the first stage whenever I send over something to be signed off. Because I know a lot of people actually don't even get sign-off these days. They just post and then hope for the best. But
what, they don't get the sign-off from the brand?
Yeah. I know a few people that have mentioned this to me that say that the brand will come to them with a brief, they'll take the brief, they'll go post it, and then that's kind of done. Whereas for me, everything gets signed off down to the words in every single caption.
Is that for a one-off post that they don't get sign-off?
No idea, but it always baffles me whenever anyone ever says that. Like, oh no, I've just posted it. It's like, oh, okay. Because everything I do just gets like, tick, 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 that's fine. Okay, you can post now. You know, just cover yourself just in case.
I was going to say, do you like that regime of having everything ticked
off? No, I do, because I do sort of pride myself on wanting to create content that my audience love but also the brand are proud of. I'd be so upset if I created something and posted it and then the brand were like, oh, this isn't really what we wanted. That would just be really upsetting.
Do you look over the legal side, and have there ever been contracts where there's a specific, you know, no-no that comes up? Because I have spoken to other people before and there is one clause on being able to use your face for, you know.
Oh,
what's the worst thing you've ever found in a contract?
I think one time, this was a long time ago though, this actually, but one time I pretty much nearly signed away my image forever.
Wow.
I think. Yeah, like the ability to use my own image, not even a photograph, like my image of myself for other brands.
And you just caught that, the last thing was that, did you
catch
it?
Well, no, Gleam caught it. Luckily, Gleam caught it in time. I'm like, what are you doing? Don't sign this. I was like, okay. So since then, I don't often sign anything unless Gleam have literally gone through it with a fine tooth comb. And that's what they're so good at. They're very, very meticulous. And if there's something wrong in a contract, they will catch it. Like the legal team at Gleam are just absolutely amazing. So I have like every trust in everything that they do, to be honest.
going back to Bulgari, they were very accommodating to the fact that you do work with your fiancé, Alex. Have you ever come into situations where it's not as well understood, because they see you as the face of your brand, that they don't realise what else goes into it and that you do need somebody to be helping you with your content?
Yeah. Do you know, I feel like this may have come up, especially a few years ago, when Alex was working for me, but it wasn't as known that he was working for me. Definitely back then, there'd be things come up and they'd say either that I need to get someone to shoot it or that they were going to shoot the whole thing. And would I be happy with it? I mean, it all depends on the project as well, because sometimes I don't really mind other people taking my pictures at all. Actually, it's quite fun shooting with different photographers. So that's absolutely fine.
With the relationship on how that works, do you see yourself and Alex working for the brand in the fro, or do you see yourself as in the fro? And is that changing over the years?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I would say me and Alex are kind of working both towards or for in the fro, I suppose. Almost as if it is its own brand now. I know especially Alex feels that way, that everything he does kind of contributes to everything, like in the fro as a whole thing.
Well, yeah. I suppose in that way it feels more joint.
He does contribute so much to everything. And now he features more in the vlogs and everything, and he's on my Instagram more, my Insta stories more, and we're kind of seen as this duo now. And I feel like a lot of different influencers and Instagrammers especially are kind of forming these duos and have, like, the photographer, like, Insta husband and things like that.
How do you feel about that, having kind of built it originally from scratch? Is there a bit of, like, resistance? Or?
Well, I don't know, you know. I think he appreciates how much, because I mean, I did it for about 3.5 years on my own before I had anyone really, well, I had Gleam, but before I had anyone helping me with my actual content. So I suppose in a way I am quite precious of it and I do like to keep it quite safe. But at the same time, he does such amazing work for me and I massively respect and appreciate everything he does and the support he gives me that I think, especially towards the fact that we're now going to be getting married, it kind of changes it a little bit, doesn't it? And it becomes more of a brand for the two of us rather than just like my baby on its own.
And you're working on these campaigns, but talk to me a little bit more about the ambassadorships that you're doing, because the first ambassador you became was for L'Oreal Hair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you've worked with Ted Baker, and now you're the face of Ted Baker. You're an ambassador of Thomas Sabo.
Yeah.
So how does an ambassadorship work, and do you feel that this is the future of the influencer world?
Absolutely. So I think this kind of partnership is literally the future. In fact, on the way here, I was having a chat with my best mate on the phone about like a one-off job that had come in. And we were both sort of saying, like, if I was to do this job, it would just be a curveball. It would be a random job with a brand that I've not really ever worked with as much before. I might use their products, but I don't work with them in the same way. And my audience would be confused, their audience might be confused, because I feel it's got to that point now where it's not as easy to do these one-off jobs. There's just no backbone to it, I don't think. Whereas if you have a partnership, whether it's 3 months, 6 months, a year, then your audience knows that you're going to be promoting this brand like fluidly throughout that time. You know, you're not going to throw in a random beauty brand or a random fashion brand that they're not used to or they've never heard of. It's just a much more of a trust thing. I only work with the brands that I am absolutely like in love with. So Thomas Sabo is just the most incredible jewellery brand. They're so me, they're so Alex, like together as a pair, we just adore everything that they do.
So you did your collaboration in the Nevada Desert.
Yeah, that was so fun, so fun. But their style of brand suits me down to a T, so I love it. So that was absolutely amazing. And then Feel Unique, I'm one of their ambassadors. Again, I've only really shopped on Feel Unique for the past like 6-7 years. So again, amazing. L'Oreal, it's just a giant. It's an incredible brand and it's one that I've used forever.
So what sort of constitutes an ambassadorship? Is it you have your 3 month or 6 month campaign and then is there a set, at least one post a month across here and then anything else is added, or you need to be able to come to X events? What can one expect from being an ambassador? What does that mean?
I feel like they're all extremely different and it depends on the brand's objectives. it doesn't have to be so prescriptive as like one Instagram a month or events or anything like that. I think it is completely down to objectives. I guess it also comes down to budgets as well, where they want to put their money into, if it's maybe an Instagram this month or a YouTube video this month, you know, that sort of thing. So it very much comes down to the brand.
You've mentioned that you think that the increase in long-term partnerships is great for the industry as a whole. But on the other side is lots of people wanting to work with micro-influencers on a media buy level. So in terms of how you would differentiate the industry, you would say you've got macro, mid-tier, micro-influencers. What would you say to a brand that wants to spend quite a lot of money on influencer marketing in terms of strategy?
Oh, that's a difficult one. Again, I think it comes down to objectives. It also comes down to their budgets. If they really want to reach a hell of a lot of people quickly and they've got a certain like limited budget or a certain budget amount, then yeah, micro-influencers are amazing. They have a very engaged audience that love pretty much everything that they're talking about. So, perfect idea. But at the same time, you could also put that budget into maybe a... I mean, what are the tier systems? I mean, what would you say I would be?
Macro.
Macro. Say if you want to put it into a macro influencer, reach their audience, but work on a longer term partnership. I mean, they both have pros and cons.
Some people are using both, and actually it's the middle people that are being cut out at the moment and are quite suffering, I have heard. Take another situation. Eventually, I'm sure we're going to see the Victoria McGrath fashion line at some point.
Hopefully.
So if you were to have £100,000 of marketing spend to use on influencers for your line, what would your strategy be to use influencers?
What a question. I love that. Okay. I would probably, because of my love for what I was saying about ambassadorships, I probably would potentially work with one or two girls on some form of ambassadorship over the year, potentially. Not having them as models as such, but as people that wear my clothing. But the clothing would have to be something that they loved. It wouldn't just be the odd one-off post of them wearing it and they'd never wear it again. It would have to be the right people that love the brand and want to wear it every single day, that sort of thing.
Would you ever use part of the budget to go through a platform, or would you feel hesitant that you wouldn't have the control over that?
Over a platform, as in like an intermediary kind of company?
Yeah.
I think I would probably rather go straight to the influencer, to be honest. Again, just because I like relationships. It's difficult for me to say because I'm kind of in the industry, so I know a lot of the girls that I would speak to. If I was an outsider brand, I think, again, I would just try and get straight into the inbox of the person you want to speak to, personally. I feel like a lot of intermediary companies are just taking a huge chunk of extra budget.
Do you think that brands are aware of some of the commissions that are being taken on these platforms?
No, I really don't.
But also at macro level, the same thing is happening with briefs that get passed around the industry.
Really? I feel like this does happen a lot. I'm sure there's a few companies especially that I've worked with that have done that as well, have taken a certain amount of commission, but you never really hear what it is. You've got no idea unless you speak directly with the brand and have your own relationship, and it's only via very kind of like whispered conversations that it's like, well, we know that they're taking this much, and you're like, what? Like, that could have been in my pocket to do more for you, to build this relationship and do more content. Whereas instead, that person that has literally sent a few emails your way,
emails,
or my way,
emails,
has taken 10 grand for something, for like potentially, that they didn't need to. I just think it's just a bit crazy.
And it's the brands, first and foremost, in that situation, I suppose, that are being stung because they have the budget that they've allocated. But I suppose at the kind of influence level, you know what you're going to say yes to for it. It's a shame that you're missing out on extra budget because you'd be able to create something better.
Yeah.
But it's actually just a complete waste of money in this field.
It is. And time. Going in between people. It's just so much quicker when you've got someone's email or someone's mobile. You can just text them and ask them things, and it just moves so much faster.
I think on the reporting side of things, the platforms do have quite good analytics. Yeah, what kind of analytics do you have to share after campaigns to people?
Pretty much everything now. If it's Instagram, I share a full insights page about how many people might have clicked through. how many people saw it, how many impressions, the reach. Same with Insta stories.
How does your engagement differ on those two?
Between the main feed?
Main feed and story.
It's funny because Instagram haven't really inflicted the algorithm on Insta stories in the same way. So I feel that Insta stories are still a bit untouched and therefore kind of works better. Mm. So actually, I feel like I reach... Well, it's hard to say, actually, because it's different. Because on the Instagram feed, people quite often don't like. So 1 in 10 people might like the picture, which is just the way it is now. A lot of people just like to scroll and not like. Whereas on Insta stories, it's calculated via views.
Yeah.
So the views are obviously going to be higher because it's just counting how many eyes have actually been on that piece of content.
Why do you think people aren't liking as much and scrolling? More options?
I don't know. Potentially. It's funny, I was speaking to someone the other day about this, about ads specifically.
Oh, yeah. Do you see less engagement on ads?
Or, yeah.
Or actually, do you see more?
No, I would say it's always across the board, usually lower on ads.
Bulgari, though, that was, what, 130,000?
Oh, yeah. But again, that was because that was views.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's like 130,000-odd because it was actual people stopping and watching the whole video.
Again, otherwise, on a loop.
Otherwise, it doesn't clock up, I don't think. I think you've got to watch the whole video for it to count as a view. So the fact that I got that many was absolutely amazing. That it was a really big success, actually, that one. But with the main feed and people liking, it's almost like likes have become currency. I almost see it as people feel as though they're losing every time they like a picture. So if it's an ad, if someone's put up an ad, regardless of how gorgeous it might be and well edited or like beautiful or how much it might sell that product, they're so reluctant to hit like because they don't want to support the fact that this person might be being paid for it. They don't want to give away that like so easily. I don't know. I feel like it's like a currency basis now. I don't know. That's just the kind of vibe I get with it, and it's a shame.
Maybe that's because I suppose brands are now less looking, or kind of educated brands are looking less at followers and more at the engagement rate. So it does have more of an impact, the like. It is a shame that there are people that don't want to support because, you know, you can't enjoy content and then expect someone not to be able to earn money.
Well, but, that's it. Like, it takes so long creating content and, like, beautiful pictures. I mean, sometimes I'll go months without posting an Instagram ad. It's annoying because sometimes they all kind of come at once and it looks like I do a lot. But I remember the other day thinking, I haven't posted an ad for over a month or two. And then all that other content is free. And it's taken me hours, hours and hours. Not just taking the pictures, going out taking the pictures, but in editing and styling and choosing the products, styling the products. All the time it's taken me getting ready to take that picture and go to these places and, you know, time on the caption, time engaging with everyone because I try and get back to as many comments as possible. But I mean, I do it because I absolutely love it. It's not that I'm complaining about it, but...
It's just something that, you know, you see finished product and don't take into consideration the time to build it. That's an interesting point, actually. When you have a ad or a campaign that's coming through, and you obviously do go to lots of different locations to shoot, do you have a percentage that you allocate to creating the content and the spend there? So for instance, with, you know, sketch, it's like I have this budget and I'll spend 5% or 10% of what it is, or, you know, and what does that look like actually as a range?
Again, it all depends on the project. If it's a bigger project and say if I need an outfit that's going to work well for the shoot, or if I need a location or a hotel room or anything like that, then yeah, I'm more than happy just to spend on it, depending on the size of the project.
So does that get incorporated within the payment fee, or do you say, this is how much it costs, but if you want to shoot here, then there's an additional stuff, or is that...?
Do you know, no, I actually don't ever really add it on. But, I mean, you're probably right in that I should. Bearing in mind that a lot of these brands will pay photographers thousands, they'll pay thousands for a location or a studio. Like, the amount of different brands that will go abroad to shoot and then they've got to send, what, 10 production staff on a plane to a hotel, pay for the hotels. And yet, me and Alex are going ourselves, organising the entire thing, taking all the work out of that brand's hands, and all they have to pay for is the content.
Do you think they get that?
No, I think a lot of brands do, especially the ones that I work with a lot. They totally see how much work goes into it, and they get it, and they really appreciate that. But I think a lot of brands still don't quite see how much they get from me going on these trips and doing these projects and giving them pictures from the Maldives, when that would have cost them so much extra if I had charged them for the flights, for the hotels, for the food, for everything that I have paid for, you know. So maybe you're right. Maybe I should be adding that on.
You've obviously always been fascinated with data and the analytics side, which obviously you are releasing a book soon.
Yeah.
Which I am very excited about and have managed to read a few sample pages. And on those sample pages, again, very much like statistic based. So I know that there was, you know, percentage increase in magazine sales for someone's being on the cover. I'm not going to give away too much of your book, but it's very interesting. So in terms of that, with the reporting, do you very much like monitor how you're impacting brands? And do you think that you are an anomaly in that case and etc.?
I think I am very results driven. I just really take this the whole thing quite seriously, in that I don't want to let down a brand who has invested in me. I'd feel humiliated, I feel embarrassed. I want to give them the best possible outcome. So for me, whenever I do get stats back or number of sales or uplifts, that is the most amazing moment, seeing that my audience love what I'm talking about. They've potentially gone out and bought that tan or that mascara. They're loving it too. They come back to me, they engage with me about it, we chat about it. And the fact that brand can see that and see that uplift is just the cherry on top of the cake, to be honest. And that always pushes me for the next thing. So if I know that a certain project did really well and my audience really loved that kind of product, then I'll try and do something again quite similar, where I know they'll love that product as well.
Have you incorporated any of your campaigns within your book to show your personal impact? And how did the book kind of come about?
So the book, how did that come about? I'd always liked the idea of writing a book, but I'd never come up with the right idea. And so I kind of just left it because I didn't want to just come out with any old thing. I wanted it to be the right thing. And I realised that after I'd finished the PhD, which was all around like retail and consumer behaviour, I'd kind of not really pursued anything else in that. And it kind of dawned on me that I was so fascinated with digital fashion and different things that have happened in the industry, like just hearing like a story. So for example, I think yesterday, was it a few days ago, Rihanna had her Fenty show and she was like live streaming from it and all this other digital stuff was going on. And that kind of thing is what inspired this book. Just all these cool things happening.
How would you describe the book? Is it in some ways a thesis?
No. No. And to be honest, I probably wanted to take it more academic than it is. At first especially, and I remember kind of chatting with a lot of different people and my publishers, and they're like, it might get too academic and it might become too niche. And I was like, you're right. Let's take it back to something much more readable, but still like informative. So it's not a thesis. It's lots of different stories, I'd say. It's these cool stories and things that have happened since the internet was created.
And did you pitch the idea to Gleam, and then they went to HarperCollins?
Pretty much, yeah. So Gleam have their own in-house publishers,
which is Abigail Bergstrom.
Yes, and she's absolutely amazing.
I like her Instagram.
Yeah, she's fabulous. And she's just so creative. She's got an incredible mind. So I went to her, we talked through this whole idea. She was like, right, get yourself a proposal together. So I wrote up a proposal. How long would it have been? Maybe about 4,000, 5,000 words of kind of like an intro and then a couple of chapters of how I kind of saw it working. And then that took a couple of months to kind of get that perfect. So then we sent it off to lots of different publishers. Luckily, we had quite a few different publishers come back. They loved the idea and went for meetings about it. And it was just a case of choosing which publisher I kind of gelled with the best and who really kind of got the book. And HarperCollins loved it from the get-go. They really kind of understood where I was going with it. They understood why I liked the idea and the way it molded well with everything I've done in the past.
Were you worried about bringing out a book as an influencer in the crowded market? Obviously,
yeah,
you have
big time, which is one of the reasons I didn't really want to write a book in the first place a while back. And it was only when I kind of stumbled upon this idea and realised that that's kind of what I really wanted to talk about, that I was like, this isn't an influencer book. I happen to be an influencer writing it, but this is the kind of book that I would have loved to have written after the PhD as my natural progression.
So did you have an editor helping you through the process where you wrote it all?
Yes.
So you wrote it
all? All of it. All 40,000 words. All mine. I literally loved every minute of it.
Yeah.
I would gladly write a second book.
I don't think that there's anything wrong with ghostwriters. And, you know, you wouldn't expect when Jordan's book comes out that she doesn't need to make a show that, you know, she actually had someone else helping her write it, because
yeah,
it's just kind of assumed. But there was obviously a big controversy around ghostwriting and influencers. What are your views on that?
It's a tough one. I think if you disclose it, and I think if you've had a ghostwriter, but all the ideas are yours, but if you're an extremely busy person who doesn't necessarily have the writing skills, maybe, and doesn't want to write, you've not really got a passion for writing, but you've got this great idea and maybe someone else could put it down onto paper better than you could, then fine, go for it. If your audience would still love to read it, I guess it's something from you to them, it just via someone else.
I suppose it's just the transparency around, isn't it?
So, you know, yeah.
I suppose it could grate and jar a bit when you've got someone saying, you know, worked so hard on writing this and sleepless nights, and it's just a bit misleading. So I suppose it's more that side of it. But
yeah.
In the early days as well, I'm sure there were people advising on the journey, being like, you know, don't say, because you'll probably get more sales if they do think that. So
well,
you can understand that it's a maturing. Yeah.
Definitely. But I think now you can't really get away with that. It's just nice for the audience, especially as a blogger. The audience want to see your words on paper. Like, say if I'd got a ghostwriter and I told them everything I wanted to talk about, even if I dictated it, they would have dictated it entirely differently to my usual tone of voice. Whereas my book is literally written like my blog posts are. Very much me, my own like colloquialisms, my usual vocab. You could read my book. If you had my voice in your head, it would just sound exactly like me.
What do you hope that people will get from your book?
I wanted something that someone could dip into, they could read from start to finish, or they could literally pick up on a coffee table, look at one of the pages and just learn a new fact or something. I just thought about what would I have wanted when I was at uni, or even now, what kind of book would I want to read that would give me something I might not already have known about that I'd be really interested to read? And that's what I wanted to write. So in this book, there's like 40 different stories, and they're all very much like moments, like really pivotal moments in the past 25 years or so since the internet started, where it's really impacted upon the fashion industry. And at the end of them, I give my takeaway from that moment. So whether that's like a bit of advice, it might be my tips on it, it might be new ideas, it might be a thought topic. So it's very much like information, and you can take information from it, but then it gets that personal element at the very end of each and every section.
Is social media, does that take up quite a bit of the book, or is it very much?
Yeah. Social media gets touched on. I touch on Pinterest, I touch on Instagram, a bit of Facebook, YouTube, blogging especially. But it, I mean, it's everything. It's not just that.
So moving kind of back to the influencer industry as a whole, what do you think that the biggest challenges are at the moment, the biggest problems within the industry?
I personally think one of the biggest problems right now for influencers as a whole is transparency and honesty, personally. I think that's one of the things that Instagram especially needs to work on, is how real people's followings are. And I know that a lot of people have spoken about it before, but it does come down to one influencer working much more over another influencer who is putting in just as much hard work, and it feels unfair. It feels very unfair. So I think that's something that needs to be sorted out soon, because I mean, it's technically fraud.
If you could create one piece of technology to solve a problem within the influence industry, what would it be?
Oh, do you know, I wish I had a little bit more time to think of that, because I could probably, like, go away and patent it and make it. But it would probably be something like that. A tool, an actual tool that worked, that could separate real followers from non-real followers to really give an actual insight of who is buying likes and buying followers and buying comments.
Yeah, the buying comments and likes is very strange. I mean, there's obviously follow and unfollow, and now that Facebook's API has been reinstated on authenticated accounts to Social Blade, you can kind of have a look there. Mm. And then I think there's Hype Auditor as well that started. But yeah, having one, yeah, which is an interesting one. But yeah, completely agree. Wanted to quickly touch on press trips, because you are always globetrotting. Creating content whilst on press trips, do they have any kind of rules about that? And also, do you think that you're going to these amazing places and it's organic, like it's press, but the output of content and its value must actually be relatively low compared to what it's actually worth, if that makes sense. Do you think that you should be paid to go on press trips to these places, and are they different?
Each case is very, very different. But I must admit, it is getting to a point where there are so many press trips now and so much is happening. Like, there'll always be one influencer on your feed that's away on a press trip, usually. I think it is kind of getting to a point where people do need to be paid, really.
Well, I mean, it's obviously making your feed look beautiful, but you're not being paid, so that's a huge chunk of time out of...
Yeah, there needs to be an incentive of some kind. I mean, if it's an incredible brand and you have so much love for that brand anyway, and you know your audience love them, and it's going to be a beautiful trip, you can get lots of beautiful content, then fine. But there definitely needs to be some sort of relationship formed there, where maybe later down the line you might become an ambassador, or that maybe there's another partnership, or just something that incentivizes you being this very loyal, supportive influencer on a trip.
How long have these sort of incredible press trips been going on?
I would say the last few years. I feel like one of the trips that I went on that people really started to stand up and notice was a Dior trip I went on, and it must have been two Christmases ago. And it was me and a couple of other girls that I know. And Dior took us away. We stayed at the Plaza Athenae, which is just a dream. We went to, like, shows. We went for incredible meals. We were all dressed in Dior, and it was just a bit magical. And I remember after that trip, bearing in mind I'd been on lots of press trips before that, after that trip, I noticed just how many people kept asking me about it, whether that was PRs or friends or my audience. Let's say if I bumped into them on a street, they'd be like, oh, how was the trip with Dior? You know, and it was then I realised just how, like,
impactful
and lucrative those trips could actually be. And then I remember after that, the benefit trip to the Maldives, again, was just so massive, big budget, and absolutely, right, ridiculously amazing. Again, people just wouldn't stop asking me about it.
I looked at that and thought, yes, that's amazing, but I'd be exhausted. How many, you were there for like 3 days, and it takes 13 hours to get there.
I know, so. I know. It was a quick one, but it was a dream.
But on that trip, I mean, yeah, very, very beautiful. Because it is purely press and organic, you can't be asked to post.
No, not at all.
So they get that. Because otherwise that would be some form of control.
Absolutely, yeah. Any trip that I go on, if the brand do show any signs of being like, you have to do this, this and this if you're going to come on this trip, then it's just a no. Because it's no longer organic. There's pressure. And I'm trying to get my own content as well, like additional organic content. There's no way I want that pressure of, okay, so now I have to do an Insta story, and now I have to do an Instagram, and it has to look like this, and the product has to be here. You know, it's too much pressure. And if I'm not being paid for that collaboration and that pressure, then I don't want it.
Yeah.
You know.
Would you be able, if you were on kind of an organic press trip to one of these amazing locations, do branded content for somebody else on those trips? Is that...
I have done, but only if it's in a different genre or it's not a competitor. So there's been the odd time where, say, I'm on a trip and it might be with a beauty brand, and I've done maybe just an Instagram shot for another brand that's completely different. I always make sure that there's no crossover and it's not going to upset anybody. Because most PRs are absolutely fine. They're usually like, oh yeah, fine, if you want to take a picture with a dress or whatever, or a completely different brand, or like a pair of hair straighteners or whatever. Totally fine, as long as it's different.
Yeah.
They're totally cool about it. Because, I mean, they've taken you away on a trip. They've taken, like, 4 or 5 days out of your schedule. They're not paying you. I'm not saying they've got any right to, but they can't really be like, you can't do any other work on this trip.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you're doing all this other organic content. Most brands are just super happy with whatever you're doing.
Do you think moving forward you'll go on quite so many press trips?
I mean, to be honest, it's hard because I'm very selective now. It's just that this year has been the most amazing brands and trips and ambassadorships, and I've been going away for those. So it's kind of hard to say, yeah, next year I'll be more selective, when in fact I'm already being very selective. So it's kind of hard to say that, but
I suppose not more selective with what you're doing, but if they, you know, if they are being incredibly lucrative for brands and it's not getting into repeat work, which I'm sure the ones you are going on does, but would you be, yeah, more inclined not to go?
Yeah, much more inclined to potentially turn it down if it's not going to benefit me or my audience in any way. Then yeah, it's just, I've kind of, I remember the start of the year saying, I'm not going to go away more than once a month. That did not happen, even slightly. But at the same time, it's been an incredible year. So I'm glad that that's happened because it's led to a lot of opportunities.
Have you ever burnt out completely and, you know, lost all your serotonin and I can't do this and I'm actually, like, apathetic?
Do you know, no, I actually haven't got to that point yet.
That's incredible.
I still
your
love
lifestyle,
it.
Your lifestyle, I look at it and it makes me tired.
Really?
Yeah.
I get tired and I get to points where I am in the worst mood ever, which only Alex will ever see. And take it all out on him. I feel bad. But
you should get one of these mood diaries that I was talking about and working out exactly when it happens.
That's a really good idea, actually.
I mean, it's not my
that.
Idea. I've plagiarised that idea from Sharmadine Reed and Emma Gannon's podcast, so I will give you a shout out there. Finally, what are your predictions for the influencer industry over the next year?
Ooh, I think there's going to be a lot of changes to things like I was saying about followers and buying and all that kind of thing. I think more things are going to come into place with that. There's a lot more tools being created that can weed out the people that are doing it right and doing it wrong. I think that's going to happen a lot. I think also the ASA are probably going to have more of a say in some things. I personally think it's working really well the way it is. They've left their mark. They've told us what to do. The majority of people are doing it right. And I think if the audience are happy and they're not confused, then let's just leave it be. But I have a feeling that things are going to change up again. So we'll see. But otherwise, I think in terms of actual content, it just needs to focus on, like, quality content and quality partnerships. And I think more and more people are realising that these longer-term partnerships are not just doing the one-off things every day. Because, I mean, there are some accounts that will post an ad every day or every other day and it just doesn't work. Doesn't work for anybody.
Do you think that you would like to be an influencer for the next 10 years?
Yeah, do you know, I probably would. As long as I've got my other things that I may be doing, whether it's another book or whether it is this potential clothing line, you never know. You never know. I mean, you can dream big.
Well, you've already perfected your Victoria Beckham pose.
Oh, well, thank you.
God.
I tried my best.
It's incredible.
I think the way influencing is right now will change over those 10 years and it will be something different. Whilst it's very saturated now and more people are doing it, I think there will be a difference and kind of a segregation between those that do it extremely well in the right way and those on the flip side. And it will become something completely new again, influencing. But in terms of that kind of space, I'd be more than happy to stay in it. Like, I love my audience. I only want to grow up more with them. Give them something more, something new, something they can be excited about.
A big thank you to Victoria for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.magazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?